Now about hoopla. You need to recognize it's a two-edged sword. You want it in order to get commitment from those above you. But when you get that commitment, it's sure to tick off your peers. In particular, established businesses with fat profits absolutely hate it when little upstarts with no profits get a disproportionate amount of company resources and attention. They are certain they need more resources and would spend them more wisely than your risky little venture. Their attitude may annoy you, but the last thing you need to have is anyone in the company rooting for you to fail. Recognize that resentment toward new ventures is natural. Keep your mouth shut if it bothers you. Humility will serve you well with your peers. Someday soon, you'll need their support. The best way to get autonomy is to earn it. If you play by the rules, you'll get your freedom soon enough. The spotlight of the company is on you. Don't blow it by overreacting. If you feel the early constraints put upon you are stifling, they are just part of the process of your parents letting go. Now, you rarely see all three guidelines at work at once. But when you do, watch out. You get a perfect storm like the Fox News Channel. Fox News was launched in 1996 by Rupert Murdoch, an entrepreneur's entrepreneur, in spite of being the owner and CEO of News Corporation, a multi-billion dollar conglomerate. Rupert wanted to get into cable news and was willing to spend whatever it took. To succeed as a cable channel, you need two things. First, you need to get subscribers from distribution providers like Comcast and Time Warner. Second, you need to get attractive content so that enough subscribers will actually watch you, the key to ad dollars. Rupert's first step was to hire someone to run the new venture. He found a match made in heaven with Roger Ailes. After several successful political campaigns, Roger had worked at NBC for 3 years, putting the cable channel CNBC on the map. He had just launched another cable channel for GE called America's Talking, but he lost it when GE used the assets of America's Talking as its contribution to creating MSNBC, a 50-50 joint venture with Microsoft, which put up the cash. Roger left NBC in frustration, but Rupert was on his tail immediately. He believed that Roger was the perfect new venture manager, bursting with ideas, energy, and passion, plus the burning desire to beat the company that had taken his baby away. With the right leader in place, Rupert set to work getting subscribers. He paid well above market rates to get the subscriber access the channel needed. Meanwhile, Roger was hiring the best talent. Britt Hume from ABC, Neil Cavuto and a flock of others from CNBC, and the highly rated commentator Bill O'Reilly. As was all happening, Rupert continuously trumpeted the new venture inside the company, making it unambiguous that he was behind Fox News through thick and thin. In the outside world, both Rupert and Roger made it so that you couldn't open a paper or turn on a TV without hearing in some form about the relentless advance of Fox. Fox News is an example of everything going right at a new venture. A high bar for people, outsized spending on resources, and lots of noise about it all. Its results tell the story. Fox quickly beat MSNBC and eventually surpassed the longtime cable news leader, CNN. Legendary entrepreneurs like Henry Ford, Dave Packard, and Bill Gates are undeniably examples of the excitement and glory of starting something new from scratch and watching it grow to astonishing proportions. But in each of your companies, opportunities of every size and variety await. Grab them. Pick passionate, driven people to lead them. Resource them with everything you've got and give them oxygen to breathe. Growth is great. And in business, it doesn't always have to start in a garage. There's nothing like the fun and sheer thrill of starting something new, especially from inside something old. The fourth chapter in the Your Competition section also deals with growth. It's mergers and acquisitions. You've seen the big party when two companies announce their merger. There's the early morning press conference on CNBC, the chatter and the buzz, the vigorous pumping of hands, the TV lights glaring, the glossy banner proclaiming the new company's name. It's all there but the confetti. And then there are the stars of the show, the merging CEOs, grinning widely, slapping each other on the back, and talking about a brave new world of synergies, cost savings, and increased sharing of value. At particularly jovial merger announcements, the CEOs wrap each other in a big bear hug, like Steve Case and Jerry Levin on that fateful day of the AOL Time Warner deal. With the excitement, there's exhaustion too, and sometimes you don't have to look very hard to see it in the faces of the CEOs at center stage. They've been working around the clock for weeks, if not months, fighting over every last nickel, not to mention who will run what. But usually, all you see at merger announcements is elation and relief. The battle is over, and now it's time to reap the deal's rewards. In reality, as the veteran of any merger will tell you, the battle has just begun. And the deal's rewards won't come without a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. If the first day of the merger is a big party, on day two, the cleanup begins. For people on the acquiring side of the deal, mountains of work stand in front of them. And while they may be pumped with optimism, there is always an undercurrent of nervousness in the room. Every deal promises cost savings. And even if you've been part of the deal team, working night and day grinding out numbers to justify it, a little piece of you has to wonder if the savings you've articulated will come to mean the loss of your job, or that of your boss, or your best friend down the hall, or the employee you've been mentoring for a year. For the acquired, the nervousness in the room isn't an undercurrent. It's a tidal wave. Everyone is terrified of layoffs. But even if you think your job is safe, life has just gotten very complex. A merger can feel like a death. Everything you've worked for, every relationship you've forged, they're suddenly null and void. Your sense is that nothing will ever be the same again. On top of it all, day two media coverage is filled with business journalists and Wall Street analysts questioning the rationale for the deal and reminding everyone that many mergers fail. Mergers do fail. In particular, it is a hard road for mergers forged primarily to capture industry convergence benefits or revenue synergies. It's easier to succeed when a merger is based on cost reductions from the combination, with any upside from revenue synergies considered a pure bonus. But either way, merger success is never a layup. And yet, companies persist in merging, and they should. In the last chapter, we looked at why organic growth is great. Every company must have the patience to constantly focus on and invest in the innovation that drives it. But mergers and acquisitions give you a faster way to profitable growth. They quickly add geographical and technological scope and bring on board new products and customers. Just as important, mergers instantly allow a company to improve its players. Suddenly, there are twice as many people trying out for the team. All in all, successful mergers create a dynamic where 1 + 1 = 3, catapulting a company's competitiveness literally overnight. You just have to do it right. This chapter is about that process, and it is intended for everyone involved, from the people making the deal to those who were affected by it several layers away. Over my career at GE, I was involved in well over 1,000 acquisitions and mergers. And over the past 3 years, I've consulted with managers during several more. Obviously, not every deal I've participated in has been a success, but most were, and over time my batting average improved as I learned from the mistakes made in situations that did not work. In the end, I've learned that merging successfully is about more than picking the right company to fit your strategy, laying out what plants you close and what product lines you combine, or how pretty your calculations of TCRR or IRR look. Merging right is ultimately about avoiding 7 pitfalls, by which I mean mistakes or errors in judgment. There may be other pitfalls out there, but in my experience, these 7 are the most common. Sometimes they can kill a merger, but more often, they significantly slow it down or reduce its value, or both. Here they are in brief. 6 are related to the acquiring company and just 1 to the acquired. The first pitfall is believing that a merger of equals can actually occur. Despite the noble intentions of those attempting them, the vast majority of MOEs self-destruct because of their very premise. The second pitfall is focusing so intently on strategic fit that you fail to assess cultural fit, which is just as important to a merger's success, if not more so. The third pitfall is entering into what I call a reverse hostage situation, in which the acquirer ends up making so many concessions during negotiations that the acquired ends up calling all the shots afterwards. The fourth pitfall is integrating too timidly. With good leadership, a merger should be complete within 90 days. The fifth pitfall is the conqueror syndrome, in which the acquiring company marches in and installs its own managers everywhere, undermining one of the reasons for any merger, getting a new influx of talent to pick from. The sixth pitfall is paying too much. Not 5 or 10% too much, but so much that the premium can never be recouped in the integration. The seventh pitfall afflicts the acquired company's people from top to bottom. Resistance. In a merger, new owners will always select people with buy-in over resistors with brains. If you want to survive, get over your angst and learn to love the deal as much as they do. Before looking at the pitfalls in detail, it's worth pointing out one thing. Many of them happen for the same reason, deal heat. I'm sure I don't need to illustrate this phenomenon in gruesome detail. You see it every time a company is hungry to buy and the pickings in the marketplace are relatively limited. In such situations, once an acquisition candidate is identified, the top people at the acquirer and their salivating investment bankers join together in a frenzy of panic, overreaching, and paranoia, which intensifies with every additional would-be acquirer on the scene. Deal heat is completely human, and even the most experienced people fall under its sway. But its negative impacts during the M&A process should at least be minimized if you keep these seven pitfalls in mind. The first pitfall is believing that a merger of equals can actually occur. Despite the noble intentions of those attempting them, the vast majority of MOEs self-destruct because of their very premise. Every time I hear about a so-called merger of equals taking place, I cringe thinking about all the waste, confusion, and frustration coming down the pike for the two companies which usually strike these deals with the best of intentions. Yes, a merger of equals makes sense conceptually. Some companies are equal in size and strength, and yes, they should merge as such. Moreover, during heated negotiations, and almost all negotiations are that way at one point, the MOE concept cools the flames. Both sides can claim to be winners. But something happens to the MOE concept in practice. People balk. They balk, in fact, because of the very concept of equality. On both sides, people think, if we're so equal, why shouldn't we do it our way? Your way is certainly no better. The result, ultimately, is that no one's way gets done. I know this negative point of view about MOEs is not shared by everyone. My friend Bill Harrison, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase during its merger with Bank One, would tell you that in the financial industry, where the assets are the brains of proud, self-confident bankers, mergers of equals are a necessity, or else everyone would walk. He may very well be right about this exception. The merger he is overseeing with Jamie Dimon, who will become CEO of the merged enterprise in 2006, is going very well. And Bill's merger experience supports his argument as well, starting with his chemical bank, MOE, with manufacturers Hanover, followed by the MOE with Chase Manhattan and J.P. Morgan. Despite this success, I'm convinced that in the industrial world, meaning just about any place but banking and consulting, mergers of equals are doomed. Daimler Chrysler is the most glaring example I can think of. Remember all the crowing back in 1998 about how the two companies were truly equivalent in all their facets? They just needed each other to globalize? No, no, the companies proclaimed. This wasn't an acquisition by a high-end, diversified German manufacturer of a low-end American car company. No way. It was two titans of industry entering a marriage made in heaven. Some of this posturing was surely done in order to help the merger receive regulatory approvals. But some of it also had to do with ego. The directors on Chrysler's board certainly weren't going to admit they'd been bought by a foreign company, and their counterparts in Germany were probably no more thrilled with the prospect of being taken over by a bunch of Americans. And so the companies tried to execute their MOE. What a mess. For two torturous years, the new company had Airbus 318s shuttling hordes of people between Stuttgart and Detroit a couple of times a week in an attempt to settle on mutually satisfactory operating processes, everything from the new company's culture to its financial systems, manufacturing sites, and leadership team. In the meantime, the merged company bumped along in chaos while managers awaited direction and shareowners awaited the realization of all those promised global opportunities, synergies, and cost savings. The ending of the story, of course, came in 2002, when newspapers reported what many people had long suspected, that the so-called merger of equals was, in fact, a pure and simple takeover. With the reality of the situation finally out there, Daimler could start running the show as it had long intended. It installed one management system, one culture, and one strategy, and the company's performance pulled out of its post-merger of equals dive. The point of this story is not to pile on Daimler Chrysler. That's been done enough in the past few years. It is to illustrate the virtual impossibility of two companies with two leaders blending seamlessly into one organization with double of everything and everyone. Forget it. People at equal companies are probably less well-equipped than anyone to merge. They may claim, during deal heat, to be entering into a perfect and equivalent union. But when the integration rolls around, who is taking charge must be established quickly. Someone has to lead, and someone has to follow, or both companies will end up standing still. The second pitfall is focusing so intently on strategic fit that you fail to assess cultural fit, which is just as important to a merger's success, if not more so. Once again, deal heat is behind a mistake that pervades many mergers, a thoughtful pre-deal analysis of cultural fit. Now, most companies have a relatively straightforward time evaluating strategic fit. Most managers, and their consultants or bankers, have the tools and experience to assess whether two companies fill meaningful gaps for each other in terms of geography, products, customers, or technologies, or all of these, and by combining, create a company that even with some inevitable overlap is stronger and more competitive. But cultural fit is trickier. Even with a cool head, the compatibility of two sets of value systems is a hard call. That's because lots of companies claim they have the same DNA. They believe in customer service, analytical decision-making, learning, and transparency. They value quality and integrity, etc., etc. Their cultures are high-performance, results-driven, family-friendly, and the like. In reality, of course, companies have unique and often very different ways of doing business. But in deal heat, people end up assessing that every company is compatible. Cultural fit is declared, and the merger marches ahead. That was clearly the case when GE bought Kidder Peabody, a disaster I mentioned in the chapter on crisis management and wrote about extensively in my last book. But just to briefly summarize here, a company with GE's core values of boundarylessness, teamwork, and candor could not merge with an investment bank with three values of its own. My bonus, and my bonus. For me, the lack of cultural fit was never more apparent than the day that the full magnitude of our problem, for lack of a better euphemism, was really hitting the fan. It was a Sunday afternoon in April 1994, and a team of GE and Kidder Peabody executives had been working around the clock since Friday evening to figure out why we had a $300 million shortfall in reported earnings. It was already pretty clear that a Kidder trader named Joe Jett had posted phantom trades, but what we needed to understand was why and how this behavior had slipped through the bank's controls, and just as importantly, its culture. I joined the team that day to get their report, and over the next several hours, we came to understand the situation and comprehend its consequences for the company. What blew my mind was that three times during the afternoon and evening, twice in the hallway and once in the men's room, the same thing happened. A Kidder Peabody manager on the team approached me with a worried look on his face asked me in one way or another, what's this going to do to our bonuses this year? 10 years later, it still sends me over the top. In the end, with the sale of Kidder Peabody to Payne Webber and ultimately to UBS, the deal ended up being okay for our shareowners. But the truth is, we never should have put the organization through the trauma that merger wrought. When it was over, I swore I would never buy another company unless its values were a close match with GE's or it could be easily brought into the GE fold. I passed over some deals on the West Coast in the 90s because of my concerns about cultural fit, but I just couldn't go down that values mismatch road again. The booming technology companies in California had their cultures, filled with chest dumping, bravado, and sky-high compensation. By contrast, our software operations in places like Cincinnati and Milwaukee were made up of hardworking, down-to-earth engineers, most of whom were graduates of state universities in the Midwest. These engineers were every bit as good as the West Coast talent, and they were paid well, but not outrageously. Frankly, I didn't want to pollute the healthy culture we had. Every deal affects the acquiring company's culture in some way, and you have to think about that going in. The acquired company's culture can blend nicely with yours. That's the best case. Sometimes a few of the acquired company's bad behaviors creep in and pollute what you've built. That's bad enough. But in the worst case, the acquired company's culture can fight yours all the way and delay the deal's value indefinitely. That's why, if you want your merger to work, don't just look at the strategic fit. Cultural fit counts just as much. The third pitfall is entering a reverse hostage situation, in which the acquirer ends up making so many concessions during negotiation that the acquired company ends up calling all the shots afterward. Sometimes you want to own a company so badly, you end up letting it own you. This dynamic is a real byproduct of deal heat, and it's so common it's frightening. Every time I talk about mergers with an experienced dealmaker, it comes up. I let it happen for the first, but unfortunately not the last time, in 1977, a few years before I became CEO. By that time, I was a veteran of dozens of mergers, so I should have known better. But I was so hot to acquire a California-based semiconductor company named Intersil that I couldn't bring myself to say no to any of the demands. The CEO was convinced that his company was operating smoothly, and he made it perfectly clear that while he liked GE's money, he didn't need its advice. Before I knew what was happening in the negotiations, I was kissing this guy's rear end in every possible way. He wanted a special, call it oversized, compensation scheme for himself and his people, because that's the way it was in his industry. I said, okay. He said we couldn't have GE people at his planning meetings. I said, okay. He said we weren't allowed to ask his finance people to change their reporting system to match ours. I said, okay. I couldn't pay them $300 million fast enough. What was I thinking? Well, obviously, I wasn't. That's deal heat for you. For several years, we muddled along, merged with Intersil. Frequently, when we made a suggestion about how the CEO might improve his operating systems, in HR, for instance, he would brush us off with, "You don't understand this industry. Just leave us alone and you'll get your earnings at the end of the quarter." It was unpleasant, to put it mildly, and far from productive. I found that I could call their headquarters for information, but unless I asked my question in exactly the right way, I would get nothing but a head fake. GE managers stopped visiting because they were given such a cold reception. Technically, we own the company, but for all intents and purposes, it was running the show. Finally, we sold Intersil at about break-even. The only thing we got from the deal was an important lesson. Don't ever buy a company that makes you its hostage. The facts are, I was hamstrung with Intersil. We didn't have sufficient knowledge of semiconductors or a senior manager with enough stature and experience in the industry to replace the CEO, let alone his management team. When we bought RCA 10 years later, a similar situation rolled around, but we were prepared for it. During negotiations, we were told that the head of NBC, Grant Tinker, was thinking of leaving. We certainly didn't have direct experience in managing TV networks, but I knew I had the bench strength in Bob Wright, the CEO of GE Capital at the time, to put a capable all-around leader in Grant's place quickly, should he depart. I tried hard to keep Grant, but couldn't. And when he left, Bob stepped right in, and 18 years later, is still running NBC. A couple of years later, a potential hostage situation developed in one of NBC's divisions, news. Its leaders openly, you might say brazenly, questioned GE's ability to manage a journalistic enterprise and started throwing up the information firewalls that are so typical of this hostage dynamic. The division's manager, Larry Grossman, led the resistance and wasn't willing to put together a reasonable budget. That is, a budget where we made money. We asked him to leave and brought in Michael Gardner, who had significant journalistic and business experience. Michael took a lot of heat for starting the process of ridding NBC News of its entitlement mentality, and he did a good job. But unfortunately, he had to leave because of a crisis that occurred on his watch. That was the NBC News show, Dateline, rigged the General Motors car to explode for a report on automobile safety. We publicly apologized for the incident. We next turned to a CBS executive producer, filled with journalistic credentials, Andy Lack. And it was Andy who really made NBC News into the high-integrity, highly profitable business it is today. A final word on the reverse hostage dynamic. In the last moments of deal heat, companies often strike an earn-out package for the acquired company's founder or CEO, hoping they will get retention and great performance of an important player in return. All they usually get is strife. The reason is that earn-out packages most often motivate their recipients to keep things the same. They will want you to let them run the business the way they always did. That's how they know how to make the numbers. At every opportunity, they will block personnel changes, accounting systems consolidation, and compensation plans. You name it. But an integration will never fully happen if there's someone blocking every change, especially if that person used to be the boss. What can you do? Well, if you absolutely want to keep the former CEO or founder around for reasons of performance or continuity, cut your losses and forget an earn-out package. Offer a flat-rate retention deal instead, a certain sum for staying a certain period of time. That gives you the free hand you need and want to create a new company. Earn-outs are just one aspect of the reverse hostage pitfall. Yes, sometimes you have to make concessions to get a company you really want. Just don't make so many that when the deal is sealed, your new acquisition can hold you up with your own gun. The fourth pitfall is integrating too timidly. With good leadership, a merger should be complete within 90 days. Return for a second to those potty-like press conferences that accompany most merger announcements. Even in pure buyout situations, the CEOs promise a new partnership ahead. The two companies will cooperate, reach consensus, and then smoothly integrate. Unfortunately, if partnership building isn't done right, it can create paralysis. The two sides talk and talk and talk about culture, strategy, operations, titles, letterheads, and the rest, while the integration waits. For a change, deal heat is not the culprit behind this pitfall. Instead, it's something more admirable, a kind of politeness and consideration for the other side's feelings. No one wants to be an obnoxious winner, pushing through changes without any appearance of discussion or debate. In fact, many acquirers want to preserve whatever positive vibes existed at the end of negotiations, and they think moving slowly and carefully will help. I'm not saying that acquirers shouldn't engage in debate about how the two companies will combine their ways of doing business. They absolutely should. In fact, the best acquirers are great listeners. They ask a lot of questions and take in all the information and opinions swirling around them. And usually there are plenty. But then they have to act. They have to make decisions about organizational structure, people, culture, and directions, and communicate those decisions relentlessly. It is uncertainty that causes organizations to descend into fear and inertia. The only antidote is a clear, forward-moving integration process, transparent to everyone. It can be led by the CEO or an official integration manager, a top-level, widely respected executive of the acquirer, vested with the power of the CEO. The process should have a rigorous timetable with goals and people held accountable for them. The objective made clear to everyone should be full integration within 90 days of the deal's close. Every day after that is a waste. A classic case of moving too cautiously and paying the price for it is New Holland's acquisition of Case Corporation in November 1999. New Holland, a Dutch company with headquarters in London and a division of the giant Italian manufacturer Fiat, was the number three player in the agriculture and construction equipment industry. Strategically, its managers were right in thinking that buying the Wisconsin-based Case, a solid number two, would allow it to finally take on the longtime industry leader, John Deere. $6 billion later, the deal was done. Given the overlap in products and markets, you would think that the integration of these two companies would proceed swiftly, especially with those cost reductions so obvious. But New Holland was a company with a European parent, and its leaders were cautious about taking over an American enterprise on its own turf. Moreover, Fiat had paid a large premium for Case. That redoubled New Holland's trepidation. My old friend Paolo Fresco, the former vice chairman of GE, and at the time of the deal, the chairman of Fiat, remembers the impact of the premium this way. We didn't want to rock the boat or sink it with too many changes. We'd pay too much for the company to let that happen. Fiat made the CEO of Case the head of the new company. In addition, most of the positions in the new organization were filled with Case managers, including COO and CFO. Needless to say, the integration was rocky. The integration team did make one big decision: to keep two brands and two distribution systems. But most everything else was left up in the air. When the market for farm equipment tanked in 2000, and with the integration stalled, the merged company tanked with it. In crisis mode, Fiat sent a new CEO, Paolo Monferino to the United States, and he launched the integration the way it should have been on day one, quickly and decisively. The then CEO of Case, Jean-Pierre Rousseau, was made chairman. Ironically, Fiat had been afraid of making that change, but once it did, its managers quickly saw that Jean-Pierre was a perfect fit for the job, and he was happy to fill its role. He was strong with customers and an excellent industry statesman. All that timidity had been unnecessary. When Congress passed the Farm Bill in 2002, the fully integrated CNH Global NV, as the company was renamed, was positioned to take advantage of the market upsurge. But as Paolo Fresco notes, we lost at least a year and maybe more because of our cultural uncertainty. The Case New Holland story is not unique. Back in 2000, GE tried to buy Honeywell, a deal, as some might recall, that never received European Union approval. But in the 7 months that we awaited the regulatory okay, teams from both sides worked hard to merge the two companies. Part of that process meant looking closely at the progress of Honeywell's own merger with Allied Signal in 1999. The two companies had been together for a year at that point, so we expected to see notable progress. Instead, we were shocked to find that Allied Signal and Honeywell managers were still in discussions about the merged company's values and behavior, and both sides were still pining for the way they used to do things. The Allied Signal people had an aggressive, numbers-driven culture. Honeywell's managers, however, liked their company's more consensus-based approach. The merged company's CEO, Mike Bonsignori, was disinclined to make a choice between the two ways of working. And so well after the deal was signed, you still had two distinct companies operating side by side with little integration. Integrating at the right speed and with the right level of forcefulness will always be a balancing act. But when it comes to this pitfall, at least you know when you're off track. If 90 days have passed after the deal is closed and people are still debating important matters of strategy and culture, you've been too timid. It's time to act. The fifth pitfall is the conqueror syndrome, in which the acquiring company marches in and installs its own managers everywhere, undermining one of the reasons for any merger, getting a new influx of talent to pick from. If acquirers are often too timid when it comes to integrating culture and operations, just as often they are too provincial when it comes to people selection. By too provincial, I mean many acquirers automatically assume their people are the better players. They might be, but then again, they might not. In a merger, you have to approach your new personnel situation as if a headhunter had just delivered you a list of fresh players for about every position on your field. If you simply stick with the going-in team, you could lose better players for no good reason. Oh, sure, there's a reason for this behavior, but it's not good. It's just familiarity. Your own people are the devil you know, and they know you back. They understand your business and its culture. They know how work gets done your way. To compound matters, it is simply harder to let go of friends than strangers. You know their families. You've been through good times and bad. You may have once told them they had long-term potential with the company. Some may have even worked on the deal. It's hard to say you're not good enough anymore. But you have to remember, one of the great strategic benefits of a merger is that it allows acquirers to field a team from a bigger talent pool. That's a competitive advantage you cannot let pass. Just be very fair in your severance package and face into the deed, even if it means saying goodbye to your own. Without doubt, avoiding this pitfall can be challenging. I cannot count the number of times we swooped into a deal and installed a GE manager in every leadership position. Most of the time, we were blissfully unaware of the potential that we had lost. But one time in particular, we couldn't be. The cost was too high. It happened in 1988, when GE acquired a plastics business based in West Virginia from BorgWarner. It was the perfect bolt-on deal, or so we thought. The business we bought included an ABS engineering plastic product line. We had an engineering plastics business of our own, albeit in the higher-end products, Lexan and Norilsk. The GE Plastics team saw one immediate cost synergy. All they had to do, they figured, was to get rid of the BorgWarner sales force and push BorgWarner products through GE channels. But there was a problem with the plan. Our sales force was a group of sharp, button-down types, accustomed to making a technical sale, convincing engineers to switch from metal to plastic. The BorgWarner sales force was a different breed. They sold their less expensive, more commodity-like product to purchasing agents the old-fashioned way, belly-to-belly, relying on personal relationships and hefty expense accounts. Our people weren't very good at that. It was a disaster. We lost 90% of BorgWarner's sales force thanks to our conquering mindset, and our ABS market share dropped about 15 points. The acquisition stumbled, and it never did reach its full potential. ABS eventually turned out to be a worthwhile addition to the GE market basket, but at far too high a price. We should have known better. 2 years earlier, we had gotten the people selection process right when we acquired RCA. On every level, the RCA deal was a win for us. With the acquisition of NBC, it met one of our strategic goals of moving into services. And at the same time, it strengthened our manufacturing base with the addition of three businesses we were already in: semiconductors, aerospace, and TV sets. In all three of these industrial cases, we took advantage of the enhanced talent pool made possible by the acquisition and picked RCA leaders to lead the merged organizations. GE's TV manufacturing business, for instance, was being run at the time of the deal by a smart young CEO who had come into the company through our business development staff. He was an MBA and former consultant, and although he had a bit of a swagger that he needed to be coached out of, his results were okay, and we generally thought he had long-term potential as a leader, which we'd told him more than once. RCA's TV business also had a very good CEO in place. He was an old industry hand with savvy and experience that our guy was clearly lacking. He, too, had satisfactory performance and was a clear candidate to run the larger merged TV business. We could have picked either CEO. But then there was Rick Miller. Rick was the CFO of RCA, and he was a big leaguer, smart, fast, full of creativity and energy. GE already had a great CFO, and it looked like Rick would need to be let go as a result. As much as we wanted to help out our manager in TV by giving him the job, it just didn't make sense. We ended up suggesting that both the GE and RCA leaders find new jobs over the coming months and gave Rick the CEO position. The two who left got great jobs elsewhere. One last thought on people selection. In the most effective integration, it starts during negotiations. In fact, before the deal is even signed. At J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank One, for instance, 25 of the top managers were selected by the time the merger was closed. That's on the far extreme of a best practice, but it's something to strive for. The main point is fight the conqueror syndrome. Think of the merger as a huge talent grab, a people opportunity that would otherwise take you years of searching and countless fees to headhunters. Don't squander it. Make the tough calls and pick the very best, whatever side they're on. The sixth pitfall is paying too much. Not 5 or 10% too much, but so much that the premium can never be recouped in the integration. This pitfall is as old as the first marketplace. People are people. When they want something that someone else wants, all reason can disappear. Again, blame deal heat. This dynamic happens at yard sales, and it happens on Wall Street. I'm not talking, by the way, about overpaying by a few percentage points. That kind of premium can be made up for in a well-executed integration. And in fact, leaving a little money on the table can be helpful if it prevents the residual acrimony that can slow an integration. I'm talking instead about overpaying so much you will never make it back. The most egregious recent example of this dynamic has to be the Time Warner AOL merger, in which a giant of a media company with real assets and products spent billions upon billions of dollars too much on a distribution channel with unclear competitive benefits. Amazingly, at the time, there was such excitement about an illusory notion called convergence that just about everyone jumped on the bandwagon. It was only after the failure of the deal was obvious that Ted Turner, a board member who was instrumental in promoting it, acknowledged on national TV that he had never liked the deal in the first place. By then, such cool-headedness was too late for Time Warner shareowners. Of course, 2000 was a time when everybody was overpaying for everything. In the publishing industry, for example, the German media giant Gruner & Jahr paid an estimated $550 million for two properties, Inc. and the new economy magazine, Fast Company. At the time, the purchase scared the daylights out of other business magazines. But during the recession that followed, the premium could only be seen for what it was, excessive. No integration in the world would have ever made up for it, a fact to which a crowd of deposed Gruner & Jahr executives would likely attest. There is no real trick to avoiding overpayment, no calculation you can use as a rule of thumb to know when a sum is too much. Just know that, except in very rare cases of industry consolidations, if you miss a merger on price, life goes on. There will be another deal. There is no last best deal. There's just deal heat that makes it feel that way. The seventh pitfall afflicts the acquired company's people from top to bottom. It's called resistance. In a merger, new owners will always select people with buy-in over resistors with brains. If you want to survive, get over your angst and learn to love the deal as much as they do. In October 2004, there was a glowing article in my hometown paper, the Boston Globe, about a thriving survivor named Brian Moynihan. Brian started his career at Fleet Bank in its mergers and acquisitions division. Then over 15-plus years, rose through the ranks to run its wealth management business, which is what he was doing when Bank of America bought Fleet in April 2004. In the months after the merger was announced, many executives at Brian's level were shown the door. Not Brian. He was promoted to run Bank of America's entire wealth and investment management division. In fact, Bank of America was so committed to Moynihan It moved 100 of its wealth managers from North Carolina to Boston to accommodate his leadership. It remains precisely unclear why Moynihan emerged on top while colleagues fell, the Globe said. It wasn't unclear to me. All you had to do was look at a quote in the same article from Alvaro de Molina, Bank of America's president of global corporate and investment banking. Brian, he said, was an immediate partner. Which brings me to the one huge pitfall common to people at acquired companies, resistance. Resisting a deal, no matter how scared, confused, or angry you are, is usually suicidal for your career, not to mention your emotional well-being. Now, I don't know if Brian Moynihan ever felt scared, confused, or angry about the Fleet Bank of America merger. And in a way, it doesn't matter, because he clearly didn't show any of these emotions. Instead, he showed exactly what you should show if you want to survive a merger: enthusiasm, optimism, and thoughtful support. Why? Because for an acquirer, there is nothing worse than laying down a boatload of money for a company, then walking through the front door to be greeted by a bunch of sour faces and bitter attitudes. Who needs it? Yes, some resistance to change is normal. But if you want to keep your job in a suddenly bigger talent pool, and frankly, if you want to enjoy work, don't act like a victim. Get behind the deal. Think of ways to make it work. Adopt the biggest, most can-do attitude you can muster. Tell yourself the good old days are over and the best are yet to come. I understand that not everyone can get their heads around this notion, but there is a price to pay if you don't. Bill Harrison recalls meeting with a very talented manager from JPMorgan Chase, who was one of the premier sour faces after the merger. "For Christ's sakes, man, you're so good. We really want to keep you," he told him. "But if you can't act in a more positive way and embrace this change, you're not going to make it." The inevitable ending to this story is that the manager was, as Bill puts it, like most people, no good at hiding his feelings. He left within a few months. In mergers, managers will always pick the people cheering for the deal, even if they are not as talented or knowledgeable as the people pouting. When there are two people to do the same job, if their abilities are anywhere near each other, the upbeat, pro-merger candidate wins. I have an old friend who worked for almost his entire career at a large insurance company, ending up with a top job in marketing, PR, and community relations. This executive was very close with the company's CEO, a relationship that afforded him all sorts of entree into the executive decision-making process. He was the CEO's right-hand man, confessor and sounding board, even though his title wouldn't suggest such impact. Then a few years ago, my friend's company was acquired by a financial services company halfway across the country, and his pal, the CEO, was promoted to chairman with a 2-year exit strategy. I wasn't completely surprised when a month later, my friend called and asked me to meet for a drink. The sooner the better. When I saw him a few days later, he was completely full on. "I'm of no value to the company anymore. They kicked my boss upstairs. He's out of the game. My new boss is far away at headquarters, and he hates me because he's afraid I know more than he does, which I know I do. I hate the mess I'm in." To make a long story short, I advised my friend to befriend his boss and find as many ways as possible to make the merger a success. If he was as good at his job as he claimed, the new CEO would notice soon enough. In the meantime, it would be dumb to get booted for sulking. My main message was, I suppose, swallow your pride, prove your worth, and start again. A year has passed, and my friend has never been happier professionally. he carved out a new position for himself, overseeing the integration of three overlapping businesses, took on responsibility of advising the new head of marketing, and finally found a great high-impact role working with the organization's new advertisers on a branding campaign. "I don't know why I took it so hard," he said recently. "I'm always telling people that change is good, and then I let change freak me out. The hardest part was talking myself out of the hole. In truth, I had to fake it for a while, but one day I finally got over myself and stopped being a pain in the ass." That's good advice to remember the next time you want to bitch about the deal, your new bosses, and the tragedy of your fate. You and your bad attitude can be replaced, and will be, if you don't learn to love the deal like the acquirers do. Mergers mean change. But change isn't bad, and mergers in general are very good. They are not only a necessary part of business, they have the potential to deliver profitable growth and put you in a new and exciting strategic position at a speed that organic growth just cannot match. Yes, mergers and acquisitions have their challenges, and all kinds of research will tell you that more than half don't add value. But nothing says you have to fall victim to that statistic. Don't let deal heat get you, and avoid the seven pitfalls. Then reap the rewards of what happens when 1 + 1 = 3. This next chapter is about Six Sigma, and I'm going to try and convince you that it's better than a trip to the dentist. In the previous two chapters of this book, we've looked at one of the more exciting aspects of business, growth, both through starting something new and through mergers and acquisitions. In this chapter, we're leaping to the other end of the spectrum to talk briefly, I promise, about what can be one of business's most dreary topics, Six Sigma. Now, I'm a huge fan of Six Sigma, the quality improvement program that GE adopted from Motorola in 1995 and continues to embrace today. Nothing compares to the effectiveness of Six Sigma when it comes to improving a company's operational efficiency, raising its productivity, and lowering its costs. It improves design processes, gets products to market faster with fewer defects, and builds customer loyalty. Perhaps the biggest but most unheralded benefit of Six Sigma is its capacity to develop a cadre of great leaders. Simply put, Six Sigma is one of the great management innovations of the past quarter century, and an extremely powerful way to boost a company's competitiveness. These days, with Six Sigma being increasingly adopted by companies around the world, you can't afford not to understand it, let alone not practice it. And yet, Six Sigma causes enormous anxiety and confusion. Over the past several years, in virtually every Q&A session, in country after country, someone in the audience has asked me a tortured Six Sigma question. You can see the interest level in the audience plummet and eyes glaze over as people brace themselves for a long-winded technical lecture, complete with graphs and charts. I'm exaggerating a bit, of course, but it's fair to say that for many people, the concept of Six Sigma feels like a trip to the dentist. But Six Sigma couldn't be less like a root canal or any other awful procedure. Done right, it is energizing and incredibly rewarding. It can even be fun. You just have to understand what Six Sigma really is. There is nothing technical in what I'm about to say. If you want to learn about the statistical premise behind the concept, or learn what it takes to become qualified in Six Sigma, an industry of books, videos, and training programs eagerly await you. But for our purposes, I'm going to be very simple about what Six Sigma means and what it does. I call this Six Sigma for Citizens, meaning those people like myself who'd like to hear the so-called elevator speech version of what Six Sigma is all about and why it matters so darn much. This explanation is not meant to satisfy scientists and engineers who actually do need to know about the statistical basis of Six Sigma in order to incorporate it into the design of experiments and complex equipment. Here goes. Six Sigma is a quality program that, when all is said and done, improves your customer's experience, lowers your costs, and builds better leaders. Six Sigma accomplishes that by reducing waste and inefficiency, and by designing a company's products and internal processes so that customers get what they want, when they want it, and when you promised it. Obviously, you want to make your customers more satisfied than your competitors do, whether you run upper crust pizza or manufacture the most powerful jet engines. In the strategy chapter, we talked about customer loyalty, and we used the word sticky to describe what you want. Well, a huge part of making your customers sticky is meeting or exceeding their expectations, which is exactly what Six Sigma helps you do. One thing that is sure to kill stickiness is inconsistency in services or products. Consider this hypothetical. You make spare parts and promise 10-day delivery. Over the course of 3 deliveries, your customers receive parts on day 5, day 10, and day 15. On average, 10-day delivery. Over the course of the next 3 deliveries, they receive their parts on day 2, day 7, and day 12. An average of 7 days. A seemingly big improvement in the customer experience. But not really. You might have had some internal process or cost improvements, but the customer has experienced nothing but inconsistency. With Six Sigma, your customers would receive all 3 of their deliveries on day 10, or in the worst case, on day 9, 10, and 11. Six Sigma, in other words, is not about averages. It's about variation and removing it from your customer's interface with you. To remove variation, Six Sigma requires companies to unpick their entire supply and distribution chains and the design of their products. The objective is to wash out anything that might cause waste, inefficiency, or a customer to get annoyed with your unpredictability. So that's Six Sigma, the elimination of unpleasant surprises and broken promises. From 20,000 feet, Six Sigma has 2 primary applications. First, it can be used to remove the variation in routine, relatively simple, repetitive tasks, activities that happen over and over again. And second, it can be used to make sure large, complex projects go right the first time. Examples of the first kind of application are a multitude. Call centers from South Dakota to Delhi use Six Sigma to make sure the phone is answered after the same number of rings for each incoming inquiry. Credit card processing facilities use it to make sure people receive accurate bills on the same day every month. The second application of Six Sigma is the territory of engineers and scientists, involved in multi-part endeavors that sometimes take years to complete. If you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on a new jet engine or a gas turbine, you cannot afford to figure out process or design inconsistencies late in the game. Six Sigma is incredibly effective in discovering them on the drawing board, i.e., the computer screen. Obviously, the amount of Six Sigma training and education required depends on where and how you intend to apply it. For the first application, simple repetitive activities, the level of training and education is certainly manageable. In order to discover the root causes of inconsistencies, people need to know what kind of information to gather and how to analyze it. The rigor of this type of training has a terrific side effect. It builds critical thinking and discipline. That's one reason why we noticed every time a business dove into Six Sigma. Not only did its financial performance improve, so did its management ranks. They all became better leaders. The second application is different. It involves a sophisticated level of training and statistical analysis. I myself have never had this kind of training, but I know from GE's very positive experience with jet engines and turbines that it works. Make no mistake, Six Sigma is not for every corner of a company. Jamming it into creative activities, such as writing advertising copy, new marketing initiatives, or one-off transactions like investment banking, makes little sense and causes a lot of wheel spinning. Six Sigma is meant for and has its most meaningful impact on repetitive internal processes and complex new product designs. At this point, you might be wondering, if Six Sigma is so straightforward, why does it cause so much anxiety and confusion? Probably because of the way it is initially presented to people. In many cases, senior management hires outside experts, scientists, statisticians, engineers, or Six Sigma consultants, to preach the new gospel. These experts, well-intentioned though they are, proceed to freak everyone out with complex PowerPoint slides that only an MIT professor could love. To make matters worse, they often present Six Sigma as a cure-all for every nook and cranny of a company. No activity is spared. Several years ago, the CEO of a well-known consumer goods company visited me to get my take on Six Sigma. "We're off to a good start," he said. "We've hired several statisticians from places like Carnegie Mellon, and we're looking for more." I thought to myself, this poor guy has really drunk the Kool-Aid. Not using those words, I told him as much. "The statisticians might be great," I said, "but for the relatively straightforward projects he was looking at, he needed everyone in the company to understand Six Sigma. The brand new experts were only going to scare people." He said he'd think that over, but I think he was just being polite. He saw Six Sigma as the purview of experts, not in the blood of his company. In time, most people come to understand Six Sigma and where to use it and not use it in an organization. Most of all, they also come to appreciate its competitive power after they've seen it in action for a few months, at which point they usually become Six Sigma missionaries themselves. So the next time you hear Six Sigma mentioned, don't run for cover. Once you understand the simple maxim, variation is evil, you're 60% of the way to becoming a Six Sigma expert yourself. The other 40% is getting the evil out.